Hello, and welcome to the Reopening Hospital Service Lines Playbook, a playbook for moving forward, part two, presented by Fulcinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions for our speakers regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 support email. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the technical support box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Fulcinelli shareholder Ross Saladay.
Thank you and welcome everybody. Appreciate y'all joining us this afternoon. As you heard, this is part two in our series on reopening hospital service lines. Playbook for moving forward. If you joined on Monday, you heard more about operational clinical considerations. Today we shift focus and we'll be looking more at reimbursement considerations, financial considerations, and work forward from there, as well as some additional operational considerations. With that, let's kind of get on into this. So, as you all know, part of the funding that was made available to providers with regards to the pandemic included advanced and accelerated payments. Just to kind of catch up real quick on those, the current status of those payments are that CMS, at least as of its last report, made about $100 billion in payments between the two programs, roughly $60 billion of which were for accelerated payments and $40 billion of which for advanced payments. If you recall, accelerated payments really flow to Part A providers, hospitals, home health, hospice agencies, whereas the advanced payments are more for suppliers, physicians, DME suppliers, and the like. These were true loan programs, at least with regard to the advanced payment program on the supplier side of the equation. That program has ended, has been over for about a week. CMS is not accepting any more new applications with regards to that program. And with regards to the accelerated payment program, if you are still considering that program, CMS is reviewing new and existing applications. They're still under review. I would anticipate that with the closure of the advanced payment program that we should anticipate the accelerated payment program similarly closing down sometime soon. As we shift over to our focus on reopening with regards to accelerated and advanced payments, what I would start thinking about would be what your operations are going to look like. What are your volumes going to look like? Have you reopened? What service lines have you reopened? When can you reopen? Because as I was indicating, keep in mind these are loans. These do have to be repaid. And the first way these are going to get repaid are going to be the automatic recoupments that CMS will institute beginning about 120 days after whatever accelerated or advanced payments you received. So beginning on day 121 post-payment, the MAC will automatically start to recoup your funds dollar for dollar, 100% of your recoupment. That will continue for a 90-day period. There is some confusion based on the language on how long the recoupment will last for hospital providers, whether that's limited to the 90-day period or that will extend out for the entirety of the rest of the 365-day period that hospital providers have to repay that fund. So the language is not the clearest. In some contexts, you can read it as 90 days. In other contexts, you can read it as existing for the entirety of the 365 days. Regardless, as you start planning for reopening, you start planning on getting service lines up and going that have been shut down, and you're considering your volume, start to think about how that recoupment is going to hit you and what impact it's going to have when it's 100% of all claims that are being submitted and all claims that are being paid for that period of time. In the event that you feel that this recoupment is going to impose a financial hardship on your organization, you can request less than 100% of the recoupment be activated. To do that, you have to make a case to the MAC. and to CMS with regards to what your financial hardship is, and they'll have the flexibility to allow for a less than 100% recoupment, but they've not issued any strict guidelines as to what it's going to take to trigger it, other than they'll consider it on a case-by-case basis. So if, depending on what your cash flow looks like, if depending on what your volumes or anticipated volumes are going to look like, you feel like you need less than 100%, you can request it. If you do request it, I would just caution that keep in mind if you do less than 100% recoupment, that's obviously going to extend the amount of time, potentially depending on your volumes, how long the recoupment will last. And if you get to the end of the recoupment period and there's still funds to be repaid, you will get a demand letter from the Treasury Department for the outstanding amounts. And 30 days after you get that letter, that outstanding amount will have to be repaid, at least presently, with a 10.25% interest rate tacked on top. There are various legislative attempts attempted to reduce the interest rate, to extend the recoupment period, to issue more favorable repayment terms for those who have availed themselves of these programs. But at least as of yet, there's no indication as to whether or not those are going to be successful. So I would say stay tuned and keep an eye on any additional attempts along those lines. If you get a demand letter from the Treasury, if you don't exhaust, if you don't repay the loan either in full, which you can do at any time, or it's not fully recouped during the recoupment period, and you get a demand letter from the Treasury similar to requesting less than 100% recoupment, you can also request an extended repayment plan. And again, that's going to depend on an individual case-by-case basis and what level of financial hardship you can demonstrate to CMS to avail yourselves of an extended repayment plan. Moving on, the stimulus funds. So under the stimulus funds program, and those were the two that I plan on hitting on today, the advanced and accelerated payments, and then obviously the public relief funds or the stimulus grant funds. At least as of to date, CMS has issued $50 billion or at least $50 billion in what they call general allocation funds. $30 billion were paid back on April 10th and then April 17th based on 2019 fee-for-service reimbursements. An additional $20 billion began to be released as of April 24th. It was seen as an augmentation of the initial $30 billion that were released. Those were based on 2018 net patient revenues, or net revenues rather. And obviously now there's also a reconciliation that has to be determined or looked at for the entirety of the period under both tranches of payments. The remainder of the $50 billion, if you remember, HHS initially released, or federal government initially released $100 billion for stimulus grant funds. $50 billion went to the general allocation funds. Another $50 billion were committed to so-called special allocation funds. Those turned out to be funds, $10 billion in funds released to high impact hospitals and high impact zones on the basis of the number of ICU beds and COVID admissions, at least at a high level. There is another $10 billion that made its way to rural hospitals, or is making its way to rural hospitals and rural health clinics on the basis of operating expenses. And then last but not least, there are two additional programs, one for COVID-related services to the uninsured population. That is a program that you can apply for through HRSA, and you can actually submit claims to HRSA for COVID-related services given to the uninsured population. If you haven't done that already, it's one worth looking into. And lastly, the Indian Health Services facilities received about $400 million. What's to come? The additional allocations under the first $100 billion, namely the uninsured population, it appears that there was roughly $1 billion that was committed to that fund, but possibly more as well. There's an additional allocation that is supposed to be released for solely Medicaid providers like SNFs, but that hasn't come out yet, nor has it been indicated how much is going to be committed to that fund. And lastly, there is an additional $75 billion under what I'll just loosely call CARES 2.0, that we don't know yet what those distribution methodologies are going to look like. So reminders for this week, or as you move forward. in general, at least the initial deadline for certifications for the general allocation funds start falling due on the 10th, so this coming weekend on Saturday, I believe it's Saturday, Sunday, May 10th, would be the first 30-day period going back to the April 10th deadline. So if you receive funds on April 10th, keep in mind you need to get your certifications in by the end of this week. There's been a lot of confusion and consternation with regards to recently released language from HHS indicating when the second tranche of stimulus grant funds or public relief funds were released, that providers receiving the funds now had to determine, based on a new formula that HHS released, whether they received an appropriate amount of funds, and if they received more, that there may be an obligation to return what they loosely referred to as overpayments. So in other words, if between the first tranche of funds and the second tranche of funds, the amount of money you received exceeded that which you anticipate you should have received under the formula, that there is either an obligation to not certify to the second tranche of funds if your first tranche exceeded that limit, or possibly to have to return funds to HHS if you received more. There's a lot of confusion over this because it's unclear how those funds would be returned in whole or in part, or what mechanism calls to the hotline that HHS has opened up. Haven't provided much clarity. They referred to so-called R23 fund reversals from your bank. Evidently, those are harder to accomplish and more time-limited than most folks believed. Because of a lot of the pushback that HHS has received, evidently they've indicated in some discussions with some provider groups that they intend to release additional FAQs today, tomorrow, or Friday, indicating how that program is supposed to work, how that return or how that calculation is supposed to be done, and what obligations that puts on the provider community. Evidently, they've dispelled the notion of the use of the term overpayments, and so they're supposed to release additional information as to how that calculation should be done, what to do if there's a quote-unquote overpayment, how that should be handled, and if they don't get the FAQs out today or tomorrow, the rumor at least is they may push out that certification deadline. So that is definitely one to stay tuned on and see what happens today, tomorrow, or Friday. As I mentioned, with regards to refunding, if you reach a determination or conclusion that a refund is owed, we understand in talking with certain providers that may not be as easy as it seems, that even though the CARES Act hotline personnel will say to perform a so-called R23 reversal with your bank, that there is a time-limited window to which that can be done. And once that expires, there's no clear pathway to push money back. There's no mailbox to send a check to. There's no account to wire funds to. So refunding mechanics, we understand, are difficult. And again, I'd stay tuned with regards to FAQs. Just quickly hitting on yet another thorny issue that has come up that we are anticipating or waiting for guidance from HHS surrounds what to do with regards to the intersection between eligibility for maintaining or keeping or retaining provider relief funds in the context of a change of ownership. And by that, I mean where you have acquired an entity, sellers received the money because the change of ownership has not yet been processed by the Medicare program, your tie-in notice has not been issued, and there's no clear mechanism to push the funds, or at least no clear guidance yet from HHS as to how to push the funds from the sellers to the buyers in that instance. It does appear that you could utilize a so-called subgrant. But most folks are waiting to hear from HHS how those complexities should be handled. They're well aware that those complexities exist. I hope and anticipate that with the release of the FAQs with regards to the overpayment determination, that they will also release guidance with regards to how the changes of ownership should be handled, as that is guidance that a lot of folks around the country are waiting to receive. As we shift from where we are today to where you're headed with regards to considerations to focus on reopening, keep in mind that with regards to the provider relief funds, The relief fund payments are restricted to only be used for preventing, preparing for, and responding to COVID-19. Funds can be used to reimburse providers for healthcare-related losses or lost revenues attributable to the coronavirus solely. Can't be covered by another source of funds. And we clearly anticipate, and HHS has indicated as well, that there will be audits on the use of these funds. So take particular care and attention as to where you to segregate these funds, how you handle these funds, how you account for these funds, so that you are in a posture to report on how those funds were utilized, what COVID-related expenses, what COVID-related losses they ran to. HHS has indicated that in the context of audits that they will anticipate that sufficient documentation of expenses and losses and methodologies are maintained. So I believe just about everybody has advised about along similar lines that providers receiving the stimulus grant funds, that you need to be segregating those funds from an accounting perspective so that you can facilitate tracking and tying your expenses and your costs, both direct and indirect, that you can identify losses, that you have set up general ledger codes for your funding programs. And by that, I mean, you should be separately accounting for your stimulus funds from your advanced funds, from your PPP funds, so that you're making sure that those are tracked and that you're able to report on the utilization of the stimulus funds, the first deadline of which will be July 10th of this year, and then you'll have a continuing reporting obligation. And given that I am going over time, Lisa, I'm going to hand things off to you, and if there's time on the back end, then I'll try to circle back. But I will cut it off there and hand it over to you.
Thanks, Ross. Really appreciate that. My name's Lisa Katz, and I'm a shareholder in our Chicago office, and thanks again for your time, everybody, today. I'm going to head to the next slide here. Oops, I think I went one too far. So, you know, as Ross has been discussing and as we talked about on part one and in several other webinars and guidance we've issued, everyone is looking at new financial models right now. Things that were true 3-4 months ago simply aren't today. And, you know, looking at each of the stimulus options obviously takes into account very specific analyses on different rules about affiliation and ownership and control and management and calculations of forgiveness, et cetera.
Joining the meeting.
But, and this all looks very different depending on your provider type, your structure, and, you know, it really requires a deep dive that's specific to your fact pattern. So first and high level recommendation there is to really take the time to do that, to figure out what works best for you and what has worked may need to be changed going forward. I want to note a couple of things. Obviously, with Medicare and CMS having the increase in accelerated payment options and the Medicaid waivers, again, all things we've discussed in more depth in other alerts and webinars, et cetera. I did want to mention a couple of things. To the extent that you have an existing line of credit with a bank, accessing those accelerated and advanced payments can have impact on those depending on what your borrowing base and the eligibility requirements are. So please take a look at that and talk to your lenders about that so that those calculations can be figured out and there's no confusion or discrepancy there. I will also mention that, again, to the extent you have existing debt, sometimes getting access to these funds, whether it's PPP, Main Street, these advanced Medicare payments, et cetera, will actually cause a default under some of your existing loan documents as covenants will prohibit additional indebtedness. So want to make sure you're transparent in those conversations with your lenders about that to avoid any issues there. Looking at your internal financial planning, obviously cash is king. We've all heard that before. All your lenders and your creditors are going to want to see a 13-week cash flow. The stress test cash flow allows you to see what happens if there's a reduction in collections or a change in staffing costs, et cetera. Again, with your vendors, understanding what has developed in ordinary course of practice in the current environment versus what the contract terms actually say. So that requires some time and effort there as well. Looking at your payables and receivables, asking the important questions. Can you collect old AR? Can you sell it? Can you track payables to make sure you're stretching them as appropriate to preserve your cash flow? All conversations that are very important to have. Communication, of course, is key. Keeping your board updated, walking through that 13-week cash flow, using them as a resource and thinking about maybe bringing in new members with distressed experience. Updating your shareholders as appropriate so as not to create panic, but to also be transparent. And of course, working with your investor relations team as well. Talk to your employees. They're going to be talking to each other, of course, and you want to give them assurance of stability so you can keep retention. Patients and residents, again, depending on your provider type, also pick up on more than you think. So be prepared to address those questions and education the staff on how to respond to those, maybe perhaps with a town hall meeting or something of that nature. So looking at external financial planning, you know, we're working with a lot of lenders and a lot of capital sources right now with healthcare providers. And overall, we're seeing that they are very, very focused on assisting their borrowers and their obligors. No one's trying to, everyone's kind of making the joke that as long as courts have been closed, no one can kind of run there to do crazy things, right, until they reopen. But overall, look at your existing covenants. What can be waived? What can be modified? Looking at what available credit is there, what funds have been approved. Maybe they've been approved for acquisitions and you're looking to repurpose those for medical supplies or other things that you need right now. If you don't qualify or if any of the other stimulus or other options haven't worked, consider taking on new debt. We've worked with a lot of lenders who are getting lines of credit out there to their healthcare borrowers almost overnight with very simple terms, very simple documents, just to get them the money that they need to keep operations open. And also, of course, talking to different lenders. I mean, everyone has their own relationships that they have today, but there's other options out there that may fit your needs as they've changed over the last several weeks and months. But overall, you know, distress is always the art of exit strategies, and there's really six potential ways to look at it. There's, you know, resurrection through the top and bottom line fixes. There's re-equitizing with new investor dollars or grant dollars in the case of nonprofits. There's refinancing. There's re-amortizing the debt. There's selling the business as a going concern. And then, of course, there's liquidation. But, you know, early intervention and planning is going to significantly help to achieve the best options instead of the worst ones. Additionally, here on our next slide, you want to manage your obligations to your creditors. You want to responsibly stretch your payables to preserve that cash flow. You want to review and protect that supply chain. Very hot topic right now and hard to do certain things if you didn't plan earlier. But, and also sometimes all the planning in the world doesn't always help, but something to keep in mind, approaching your landlords proactively. Don't just wait and not send a check. Have those conversations proactively. Many of them are giving breaks and changes in terms. And evaluate the impact of the tightened credit terms. You know, anticipate that credit tightening. Everyone is doing what you're doing, so don't assume that you can keep those traditional terms. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ryan Morgan, to talk about some payer strategies.
Hi, everyone, and thanks, Lisa. I'm in Polson County's Denver office, and I'll note real quick that Colorado is currently in the process of relaxing its stay-at-home orders, and the state is starting to open up. I kind of feel like this is a timely webinar locally, and I hope that you all are finding it useful as well. So Ross has talked about advance and accelerated payments from the federal coffers and HHS stimulus funds. Lisa talked about approaching lenders and creditors to increase or maintain cash flow. And now I'm going to turn to kind of short and medium term payer strategies to achieve really the same goal, ensuring adequate cash flow, especially during the reopening process. Now, many hospitals are struggling to make payroll or make the next lease payment. And the question we need to ask here is, how do we turn our traditional revenue spigots back on, and what do we have to think about when we do that? So the next few slides are drafted kind of with commercial payers in mind, but many of the concepts will apply equally to your traditional Medicare and Medicaid programs, and they'll certainly apply to Medicare Advantage and managed Medicaid since those programs are operated by commercial payers. So one of the difficulties with the payer strategy approach is that there are going to be lots of differences in the rules, not only from payer to payer, but also from product to product, and as well as from state to state. So there's not going to be a single one-size-fits-all approach to your payer strategy. It's going to differ for every hospital and for every payer. And to implement a payer strategy effectively, it's going to take a little bit of diligence and effort on your side and the front side to understand what the rules are from all of the different payers. Now, the first step to make it, to any kind of payer strategy is to make sure your hospital is eligible for reimbursement from a compliance perspective. As Lisa mentioned, all of the normal rules have changed over the last 2 months, and they'll continue to change in the next few months, since this pandemic really isn't going anywhere, at least in the foreseeable future. So we need to understand what the rules are to ensure compliance with the current rules. And this reopening period should give us some breathing room, since we're not dealing with acute patient surges, presumably, to confirm our compliance standpoint. And there are really two major areas of compliance to consider. The first is compliance with applicable laws and regulations, and the second is compliance with payer policies that lay on top of that. From a legal perspective, there have been changes to state licensure laws, not only on your facilities, but also with respect to your providers. So, if your hospital has taken advantage of relaxed bed capacity or location licensure rules, if your advanced practice practitioners are practicing, at a higher kind of near the top of their license now when they weren't before, and certainly telehealth is kind of in the same bucket of state licensure rules that have changed recently. All of those rules need to be reviewed in detail right now. Again, perhaps you did it a couple weeks ago. Check them again now because they're continually changing. Same thing on the CMS waiver side of things. Many hospital conditions of participation have been waived, but CMS hasn't always been clear about the contours of the waiver. And in some cases, it's not even clear which particular conditions of participation are waived. So to the extent you're operating kind of outside of your normal COP posture, again, time to take a look at those. And the third bullet point from the laws and regs perspective is really a CARES Act bullet point, and it's a little bit narrow, but I wanted to mention it because I think it's important. The CARES Act, as almost everyone knows, requires plans to reimburse providers for COVID testing, and it sets a rate. It says the plan has to pay either the negotiated contract rate or the cash price listed on the provider's website if there's no negotiated rate. Now, the CARES Act, and it's implicit in that requirement, the CARES Act also requires providers to actually list their cash price for testing on a public website. If you haven't done that already, put that on your to-do list right now. There's a $300 per day civil monetary penalty for noncompliance. That's from the government standpoint. Of course, payers will very likely point to this same requirement to deny payment if there's no cash price, or at least reduce payment underneath what you believe to be your cash price when payment comes due. Moving to compliance with payer policies, certainly telehealth is one that has changed dramatically, and I know Lydia will touch on a little bit of that later on. COVID-specific policies, almost every payer has rolled out new policies or updated old policies in light of COVID. Some of these policies are, they were rushed out very quickly, and now is the time to ask questions about them if you have questions about how they're going to be applied. I know there are a number of coding-related policies on how to use ICD-10 codes for certain COVID diagnoses, and then similarly, there are payer FAQs that have been pushed out on really just guidance on what how to treat COVID-related claims. I would recommend for all the policies and FAQs that you find on the PARwebsite, download a hard copy of them with a date stamp, because I believe those will continue to change. And if you have to defend your eligibility for reimbursement down the road, it would be helpful to have the policy that was in place at the time. It might not, payers might not hand those over willingly later. Compliance is of course important, and I mentioned this because, you know, non-compliance with laws or payer policies could be the basis for a payer to deny, reduce or recoup payments. Audits for this time period will absolutely be coming, you know, in the next 6 or 12 months. The changing rules are really just fertile ground for payers to challenge payment, and payer SIUs will absolutely be looking at compliance with whatever rules they deem important and auditable at the time, to look back and to recover some payment from you. So a little bit of due diligence now can really go a long way down the road. So with, you know, once we're comfortable with our compliance posture, you can turn to coverage considerations. There are new covered benefits out there. There are new benefit structures out there. Providers have pushed out new modalities of treatment, as everyone has kind of responded very quickly to the COVID pandemic. So we need to understand how these items and services are covered by each applicable plan. And again, that takes quite a bit of work. So it's going to be a matter of reviewing which benefits have been expanded in light of COVID, again, on a payer-by-payer basis. I'll note that CMS has relaxed enforcement of its longstanding prohibition on mid-year benefit enhancements by Medicare Advantage plans in connection with COVID-19. And some state departments of insurance are doing the same thing. So you could see a number of benefit plans with new covered benefits that have just rolled out in the last days or weeks. We need to review payer policies. Again, we touched on this in the last page, but the payer coverage policies in particular. One of the things we should focus on is what is a COVID-related treatment? I think we all know that the $0 copays and in-network payments for out-of-network services are a requirement, but what is the, you know, what's the difference between a COVID-related treatment and a non-COVID-related treatment from the payer's perspective? Does the payer need a positive test result, or is a diagnosis enough? You know, that type of detail is what you want to get to when you review the payer policy, so you understand what kind of documentation you have to support your claims. For new service models, of course, telehealth being the big one, but also, you know, any new service sites that you've set up, that type of thing. Again, confirm compliance with them, not only from the payer policy perspective, but also from, you know, if you're relying on any waivers or flexibilities from state or federal authorities, you need to have a plan in place to monitor those waivers and payer policies and to adjust the service if the waivers or flexibilities go away or if the payer policies change. This last bullet here is loss of coverage for patients. I just kind of added it in the coverage consideration because so many people have lost their jobs during this pandemic. As of yet, there has been no federal dollars going toward COBRA coverage yet, but that might be something that's in the next stimulus package. We'll see. We've gotten a couple of questions from hospitals about whether and the extent to which they can support patients in the form of payment of premiums. That is always an area that's difficult from a legal perspective. So that should not be something that's an automatic or even easy thing to do from your perspective. So I'd recommend running in all of those efforts by legal departments first. All right, reimbursement considerations. Payers are sitting on cash right now. They haven't been paying for elective procedures for about 2 months. That's an enormous amount of utilization that they're not paying for. United reported in their earnings call a couple weeks ago, reported that their Q1 earnings were up 3% year over year. Anthem reported that its earnings were up 7.5% year over year. Those are enormous numbers for Q1, and a Q1 that wasn't even impacted by COVID, and materially at least, in January and February. Almost all payers are estimating that the bulk of their 2020 earnings are going to come from quarter two. The point is they have a ton of cash right now. And you know, they're looking at ways, their accounting tricks to pay that cash forward and to otherwise avoid a bad-looking medical loss ratio. And of course, there's uncertainty in the stock market and in their other investment opportunities. So, you know, payers are maybe not be willing to part with cash that easily. But, you know, hospitals also have a little bit of a hero status right now. And the public perception of hospitals is really, I think, at all time high. So there's a combination here that may present a window of opportunity for hospitals to adjust their relative positions with payers and really increase the flow of that spigot. Right? And this slide kind of outlines a number of ways you might want to approach payers to take advantage of that potential opportunity. The first bullet point, I think, is one that you really should be taking advantage of already if you're feeling the pinch from payers, really all of the administrative hassles that payers typically impose on you from day to day. You know, if those can be waived or pushed down the road just so you can get by, we found that a number of payers are open to that. There are a couple of states actually that are putting quite a bit of pressure on payers to offer that type of flexibility. Second bullet point, renegotiating long-term rates and resolving outstanding disputes. If you have a new contract or a dispute on the table right now, this might be a good opportunity to push for resolution, quick resolution of it. Everyone's kind of focused on COVID, and you know, no one wants to make at least the payers don't want to make a big fuss about not paying providers right now, at least publicly. So again, might be a good opportunity to solidify your cash flow. Your value-based contracts and risk contracts, this is an interesting point. If you know, the same way payers are affected by COVID, you know, your risk-based contracts might be affected in the same way or in a similar way. So take a look at how, you know, what your quality metrics are in risk-based contracts. Take a look at what kind of downside risk you have, if any. Again, stop-loss insurance, if that's something at play, take a look at, you know, what your claim filing procedures are there. If you have a system-affiliated ACO or CIN that might have these types of arrangements, you know, maybe check on that side of the house to see things that they can do to take advantage of this position right now. Cram down amendments, we're kind of seeing a couple of them from payers right now. These are the unilateral amendments that payers typically have. We've seen a couple with respect to COVID testing where there wasn't a negotiated price for testing, and those are being pushed out at, you know, a very preferable rate for the payers. Keep an eye out for those. Don't sign or accept amendments without taking a very close look at them right now. And I'll just note, lastly, you know, a couple of commercial payers have engaged in offering advanced or accelerated payments to providers. United says that it made about $2 billion available for that purpose. If you've accepted any money from a commercial payer for that purpose, you know, now's the time to take a look at what your repayment obligations are, if any. Okay, and finally, a few quick operational considerations. I'm not a revenue cycle guru. There are surely many more operational considerations that should be added to your list, but these are kind of my high-level need-to-think-about considerations. First, you know, on reopening any service line, reaching out to your referral sources and others in the community to, you know, make sure that schedule is full on day one. You don't want to lose an opportunity when it becomes available. That, of course, you know, comes with its own strings. We need to be careful about your fraud and abuse issues and payer discrimination issues. So make sure you do that in the right way. Your normal, and this is the lawyer in me really, but documentation, document is going to be the key to ensuring your right to reimbursement during this time. So just reinforcing best practices in your organization for those service lines that have been closed for a couple weeks and maybe some people are a little bit rusty. You know, now's the time to reinforce those best practices. And then internal preparations to speed up claim submission. You know, prep your coding and billing personnel who haven't who haven't looked at a elective procedure code in 8 weeks, right? Do some refresher training. If you've outsourced your billing or coding, you know, start talking to your contractor now about how to shorten that claim submission timeframe. And again, on what the expectations are from payers on coding and billing. And then finally, there's an opportunity, I think, to engage your medical staff and have certain communications with them about documentation expectations and on timely documentation. And if you have, you know, employed physicians on your staff, you might have an opportunity to consider more formal approaches to ensure prompt documentation, all really in an effort to get those claims out the door as fast as possible. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lydia to really focus on telehealth.
Thanks very much, Ryan. So this is Lydia Nico-Najam. Thanks everyone for joining. I'm in the DC office, and I'll delve a little bit farther into expanding or reopening your service lines through telehealth. As you probably know, the telehealth rules, both from the payer side and the state side, have been very strict. So, for example, the Medicare telehealth services, in order to be covered, have to generally follow these five rules. There has to be an eligible Medicare beneficiary at an originating site that is enumerated by CMS, meaning like a physician's office or a hospital, and that is generally located outside of an MSA or in a HIPAA. There has to be an eligible provider, meaning a physician or a nurse practitioner, limited list, through an audio and video technology. There are very limited services that are allowed to be provided through store and forward, and non-telehealth services generally that are allowed to be provided through audio only. And then the service also has to be listed on CMS's list of eligible telehealth services that the CMS issues in or updates in the physician fee schedule, final physician fee schedule yearly. In addition to that, those services, and Ryan touched on that, have to also be compliant with the state laws, meaning that the laws that matter are where the patient is at the time of the services being provided via telehealth. So it's very important that the provider always check where the patient is during that time. They may be traveling, they may be moving, and the provider wouldn't know. And the rules in those states that matter are to what extent those providers have to be licensed in the state. If they're not licensed, they're as out-of-state providers. And then each state has their own standards of care for telemedicine services, how the patient has to be consented. Certain states have very specific rules about that, what sort of documentation and notices must be provided and kept. And then in terms of treatment, how the physician-patient or the provider-patient relationship can be established for new patients versus, and then how established patients may be treated. And a lot of this also centers about ability to prescribe, as that is often the outcome or the treatment of a diagnosis or the visit. And there are particular rules for prescribing controlled substances. Each state has its own Controlled Substances Act, and they may have a requirement for a particular registration there. So it's very important to understand those rules. In summary, in order to provide telehealth services in compliance with the payer and the regulations, federal and state regulations, you have to be in compliance with the Medicare telehealth rules that we just discussed. There has to be a medical necessity that is substantiated and understood through the Medicare coverage and payment criteria, for example, as one of the payers that is outlined, for example, in the CPT codes in addition to the manuals, et cetera. The state telehealth rules, also the DEA prescription rules for controlled substances, especially. I mentioned that state laws control the prescription of controlled substances and to what extent that can be done through telehealth services. The DEA, the Federal Controlled Substances Act enforced by the DEA, has the same rules. Until this public health emergency, controlled substances for new patients could not be prescribed without a face-to-face visit, essentially. And then, of course, you have to consider the data privacy and security, because obviously if you're providing services through telehealth, you're using telecommunications. And so you have to make sure that the protected health information of each patient is properly protected under HIPAA, and so that the vendors that you're using for the way to communicate with the patients is also compliant with HIPAA through business associate agreements, for example. So in order, those are very onerous requirements, and to a certain extent, this is why telehealth services have not been as widely used. And so in order to allow for telehealth to be used now to provide more telehealth services or more services through telehealth so that we can continue to abide by the social distancing, especially, CMS has provided these blanket waivers that are included here. So in terms of the rules we discussed for Medicare, patient location now no longer is limited to those geographic and facility areas. Now the patient can be at home. There's also a way now to not only claim the professional fee with a code modifier 95 so that you're reimbursed as if you were there in person at the same amount, but if a patient is a registered outpatient and a patient's home is included as a provider-based location, then the facility may also charge for that facility fee for the telehealth service. In terms of modalities, there are certain CPT codes now that in an unprecedented way are considered telehealth and may also be provided via audio only. And CMS has expanded the list for the covered services, including, you know, last time over 80 new CPT codes. Although I have to emphasize those are temporary and for purposes of dealing with the pandemic right now, which we'll underscore at the end of the presentation and by turning it over to Larry, what is going to happen permanently. In terms of the what I call the medical necessity and other service requirements, for purposes of reimbursement and under Medicare, there are some loosening of rules for providers to be able to provide these services across state lines through telehealth. As we discussed, patients tend to move around and how to deal with the physician-patient relationship establishment through telemedicine. There has been previously a lot of limitation to providing telemedicine to established patients who the providers have seen face-to-face. Now that's no longer necessary. There are new providers, examples here for rural health and QHCs that can provide the services. And then I think this is a big one, and we're gonna see how it really plays out, but CMS has allowed for direct supervision now to be able to be provided through video and audio communications, whereas before for direct supervision purposes, the physician had to be physically located in the same area as the clinician providing the services. But here, the direct supervision that CMS has loosened up is a definition of direct supervision, meaning that you don't have to be the provider that is directly supervising another does not have to be physically present in that space if clinically appropriate, which can also be applied to incident to Medicare billing services, which is out of scope of this presentation, but it seems like this is a big deal and will allow to further protect the providers and the patients or clinicians who are rendering services. In terms of the states, the complementary waivers done through the governor's executive orders and any supplemental orders by the Departments of Health boards or the Surgeon Generals, for example, and to very varying degrees among the states pertain to waivers of certain state licensing requirements for the duration of the pandemic, requirements for audio video similar to what Medicare or CMS has done, establishing a physician-provider, patient-provider-patient relationship through telecommunications, and then the various rules of prescribing that we've mentioned that at times match DEA's waiver, which it's one slide over, but essentially for the duration of the pandemic, DEA is allowing for use of telecommunications to prescribe controlled substances to new patients, which was not previously allowed.
Also, in order to expand the use of telehealth, as you can see here, there has been some waiver of cost, or there's a cost-sharing flexibilities where waiving of in cost-sharing obligations for the telehealth services will not be, at this point, enforced for purposes of fraud and abuse. And I've already mentioned this is the DEA declaration of loosening some of the requirements during the pandemic. In terms of data privacy and security flexibilities, as I mentioned, one of the requirements for using telecommunications is ensuring that your vendors are HIPAA compliant, and you do that through a business associate agreement. So essentially, OCR at this point is recommending that you may use HIPAA compliant vendors with whom you do not yet have a business associate agreement, but obviously, the recommendation is that you will ultimately get a business associate agreement, but at this time, OCR will not enforce it if you don't follow the HIPAA rules and have a business associate agreement before using the vendors. Here are some examples of the non-public facing applications that may be utilized. Providers should never use public facing applications. Here are some examples. And as I mentioned, the bottom line is that if there's an emergency and you must use a vendor with whom you do not have a BAA yet, they should be HIPAA compliant. In terms of text messages, obviously only secured messaging applications should be utilized. And a note here that all texts should be related to treatment of healthcare emergencies to comply with the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Bottom line is that these waivers right now are all temporary and are likely to end with the pandemic. Obviously, you know, certain telehealth services will be well utilized and there will be huge interest for them to remain, but which ones is unclear. So with that, I will turn it over to Lori to discuss the next steps.
Great. Thanks, Lydia. This is Lori Oliver from the Seattle office, and I'm going to dive into how do we innovate and thrive in the face of these challenges. So just a note that while we talk about hospitals as a group, they really are very different depending on your geography. Are you urban or rural? Are you in a hotspot or not? What kind of care do you provide? Are you a quaternary facility or are you a community hospital? We've talked about financial health. Were you healthy pre-COVID and what is your status now? And obviously culture is a really important variable as well. Is your organization one that innovates and embraces change, or is yours one that needs a crisis to move forward? And are there changes you've made that folks maybe were slow to adopt but are now embracing, and how do you take advantage of that? So in terms of innovation opportunities, we've identified a number of categories. So when you think about the public good, communication and advocacy, we've touched on that already, but I think we'd all agree that there has been unprecedented levels of communication across many different audiences in addition to your patients. So vendors, donors, advocacy groups, elected officials, your city, state, county, federal agencies, financial institutions, lenders, a lot of great teamwork with one goal in mind of how do we keep people healthy. And there are opportunities for increased advocacy in there. So really encourage you as you're thinking moving forward to use those opportunities to tell your story at a local level and influence the national dialogue. As everyone's noted, many of these programs are temporary at this point. So telling the story of how they have worked successfully with minimal regulatory risk is a really important opportunity. So too is the continued partnership for public health. Depending on which epidemiological model you're following or watching, I think we can all agree that we are moving to a new baseline and we don't know exactly what that will look like, but we know we'll need continued cooperation for public health. Maybe you're in a state that has a really good, robust public health provider network like Washington does, or you're in a state where you have been building that and enhancing it while you're in the middle of the pandemic. And might be important then to take a breath and formalize roles and expectations so that you can continue to move forward smoothly as different parts of your operations reopen. And with that in mind, thinking of hospitals as part of our national defense, and how do you think about the choices you'll make going forward from a community benefit perspective, as well as being part of regional responses to future surges or hotspots? So some opportunities in there. Looking to clinical, lots of great clinical innovation has actually taken place in the face of these challenges. So we have care model changes and lots of movement to digital strategies like chat, e-visits, e-consults, remote monitoring, moving things that actually don't have to be face-to-face to virtual. So pause and ask yourself, what changes have you made that should be permanent because it furthers the care in your community? And what changes should you make to prepare for another surge so that you don't have to shut down as much of your operations and your patients will have confidence to continue to come in? There's also been lots of information already provided and discussed in the alternative sites of care space, and we have some Hospital Without Walls materials on the Pulse and LA website, but there are continuing opportunities to say, how do we innovate to keep providing care in low-cost settings? Also think about the need for increased services. You can't turn on any media outlet without acknowledging that behavioral health is an area of great need, and how are you integrating that in your primary care settings? You're going to have patients who are getting notified through the public health system. Actually, that may not be your patient. So what's kind of your package of care to that segment of the community who may not have a long-term connection to a health system? And how are you using your population health infrastructure from value-based care and other activities to really help you bring your service lines back online? In the business arena, there are, as was touched on earlier, there was discussion about supply chain, and we've done lots of work as hospitals over the years to manage our expenses and standardize, use volume discounts, not have so much inventory. You might consider revisiting those in light of what your experience has been with the supply chain disruption. We've also talked already about the importance of you have new compliance risk now from the waivers and the different stimulus programs. So be sure you are working with your compliance professionals to plan for that. And obviously a perennial issue for hospitals on use of data. Did you have the ability to use the data to inform your strategy and response? And if not, what investments do you need to make to be able to do that? Lastly, lots of opportunities to revisit your strategic plan. So your pre-COVID plans are definitely in need of a refresh. So when you think about your capital plans or your service line investments, what investments might you no longer need to make? Or if you still think you need that building, maybe you need an entirely different design and purpose for it. And then of course, we also touched on in the financial status, you might need to revisit your needs around partnerships, affiliations, alliances, and acquisitions, because your needs have changed. So maybe you're lucky enough to have good financial health and be in a position to acquire a distressed asset. Perhaps your status is you've become a distressed asset as you are trying to manage bringing in revenue and thinking about cutting expenses and so forth. So there are some good opportunities there depending on your position. So as we look forward, it's really important that we're all following the reopening guidance from public health officials, and that is going to inform the pace at which we can move forward in reopening service lines. It might also lead to a stop and start in some geographies, and really being prepared to meet the three-part challenge of continuing to care for COVID-19 patients while you're reopening service lines and preparing for surges. And how do you do that in a way that the consumer, your patient, has confidence and will come in for those procedures. And of course, not losing sight that depending on your position as a in the local market that you have or region, there are strategic opportunities and opportunities to innovate and thrive. So trying to keep your eye on that opportunity while you're dealing with a host of complexity is obviously its own challenge. So thank you very much for joining the webinar. There are obviously great lawyers at Polsinelli who are prepared to assist your organization to respond in this fast-changing environment. And I think we all want to thank you as hospitals on the front lines for everything that you're doing to keep us healthy. So with that, let me pass the baton back to Emma, who will give us some wrap-up.
Thanks, Lori. This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation and copy of the slides will be available on the Polsinelli website and COVID-19 blog within 24 hours. If you have questions regarding today's content, we encourage you to reach out to our COVID-19 support email. Thank you for your participation.